resource with which to defend yourself from my talking. One such resource is this paper on the archive, which is a review article with a very similar perspective to the one that I've been advocating, in case you want to do some reading over the weekend. So yesterday, there was a tutorial, which I hope many of you participated in. Callan tells me that there was some mystification about the relationship between the content of the tutorial and how we've been occupying ourselves in these lectures. And I guess I'll try to take some measures to rectify that today. But before I do that, I want to recap where we are and make some amplifying comments. So here's the recap. The sort of general statement that I've been trying to sell you is that gravity, theories of gravity, this is a y, gravity in certain spacetimes, in spacetimes which are d plus one dimensional, with certain kinds of boundaries, with time-like asymptotic boundaries. So the statement that the space-time has a time-like asymptotic boundary is part of the specification of the problem. And the best example is Ente de Sitter space. Such things correspond, by some correspondence that we're still elaborating, to some quantum field theory without gravity in d dimensions. And an important special case, let's say, important both because it's one where we can make things it's one where we've understood more and where there's extra symmetry, so it's easier to check and all kinds of nice things, is the case where the space-time with the time-like asymptotic boundary is asymptotically ADS. Let's say asymptotically ADS d plus 1, this A is for asymptotic, corresponds to a conformal field theory in d dimensions. And for example, the isometries of the space-time isometries of ADS correspond to the conformal symmetries, the relativistic conformal symmetries of this field theory. And I guess the most important message is that the extra dimension, the plus one here, has to do with the resolution scale, the RG scale in the field theory. And further, the fields in the bulk propagating in this bulk geometry, such as the metric on the spacetime, correspond to operators, and in particular you can think of them as describing the possibly running coupling constants in the action of this quantum field theory. And part of the reason that I emphasize this point is to say that, you know, this case where the quantum field theory is scale invariant, the case where it has this special scaling symmetry is just a very special case of the correspondence where the coupling constants are not running as a function of scale, they're just constants, but the correspondence is, in fact, much more general than that. Okay, and then finally, I guess I'm out of room over here. Let me go over here. The sort of quantitative, the way in which this, let me make one more comment. A definition of quantum field theory that many people like, I guess many people means sort of very formal theorists, that a general quantum field theory is, according to some people's definition, a UV fixed point. That is some CFT perturbed by relevant operators. You take a CFT of this kind, and then you add to its action some relevant operators, to which, you know, produce all kinds of mass scales, and in this way you can produce whatever CFT you want. So for example, QCD is a free EV fixed point of just non-interacting quarks and gluons perturbed by the Yang-Mills coupling, and it flows through this interesting quantum filter. And so you see, this means that whatever quantum field theories we can get by perturbing the conformal field theories that we can describe in this way, we can also describe in this way. Okay, and then the quantitative content of this correspondence is that to compute the partition function of the quantum field theory as a function of sources for whatever operators whose correlation functions you might want to compute, let me call the sources phi naught. Yesterday I called them j. In the limit where this correspondence is computable, this thing is e to the minus the bulk action. So this is the action of the gravity theory as a functional of the boundary conditions. As a function of some solution which solves the equations of motion, the bulk equations of motion, and which satisfies the right boundary conditions, phi goes to phi naught as e goes to 0. So if you like, this thing is the saddle point approximation to some mysterious quantum gravity path integral. And this saddle point is sharp. That is, the gravity theory is classical. Well, one condition that we saw was that this happens when the ADS radius, which I called L to the d minus 1, over the Newton constant, this d plus one-dimensional Newton constant. This is not a power, that's a label. So this is the Newton constant in the d plus one-dimensional gravity theory. This is the ADS radius when this thing, which we showed is proportional to some number n squared, which is the number of degrees of freedom in the field theory per point. This is of the dual theory. So this equality we saw by this holographic, this just came by counting degrees of freedom using the holographic principle. So this was the last thing we did last time. And so the saddle point is sharp when this quantity is much, much bigger than 1. Because you see, this thing is proportional to the bulk action. The bulk action scales like this thing. And so if we scale up this thing, the saddle point will be very sharp. That is, you know, the integral we're doing is an integral like this. So this is an integral which you can do by saddle points. So this is an equation I wrote before. This is an integral that you can do by saddle point if this number n squared is much bigger than 1. All right, so that's the recap. I want to make, are there any questions? You guys should ask me questions. I need more feedback. Otherwise, I'm just going to ramble on and on. Maybe I'll start interspersing my comments with just completely bewildering remarks that don't make any sense. I will do this if you don't ask questions. I will do it. Maybe I'm doing it already. okay, so let me make some comments about large n, which may be bewildering. I don't know. We'll see. Comments about large n, about this n squared. So this, you know, so I introduced the symbol n squared as a, you know, this was my definition of n squared here. It's the number of degrees of freedom per point in the quantum field theory. You know, I could have called it some other letter, just like, you know, without the square. But I called it n squared because you've already been beaten into submission by Pedro into thinking that the way that this should work is that this should be dual to some kind of matrix model, that there should be some kind of a tuft counting involved. And indeed, this is the most prominent and well understood and prominent and maybe best example of how to get a quantum field theory where there's this big honking n squared in front of the free energy. Is this a tuft limit of matrix models, of a matrix model. So where a matrix model includes Yang-Mills theory. Yang-Mills theory is a special example of a matrix model where the physical operators, that is, the things appearing in this list of operators that I've been calling O. Remember, we had some I had this mysterious list of operators with, which were called curly O with some label that I didn't really define, where the physical operators are things like OA. The set of these OAs includes things like trace x to the k, where x is the matrix, and we take a trace of the matrix, or we multiply the matrices together by matrix multiplication. That's what the x to the k means. And we take a trace because, in a gauge theory, it's because the physical operators are gauge invariant. This business of taking this Tuft limit, this large n limit where n goes to infinity and the coupling constant scales appropriately to have finite interactions, accomplishes several things for us. The first thing it accomplishes, it's the matrix of the matrix model. It could be the field strength of the Young-Mills gauge theory. It could be some adjoint scalar field. A matrix that you can multiply. And the point is that this is a gauge invariant object, and therefore it creates physical degrees of freedom. And I'm being brief here because I know Pedro already said quite a bit about these things. If there's some piece of information that's missing, since I don't know exactly what he said, please ask. Please ask. And so this accomplishes several things. This is a tough limit. I should have said X is an n by n matrix. Right. And so the number of degrees of freedom per point here are, n squared for each matrix times the number of matrices. There's some order one number here that I am ignoring. So this accomplishes several things. The first thing this accomplishes, it makes the saddle point well peaked. If you compute the partition function of such a theory, it's dominated by planar diagrams, right? The planar diagrams dominate, and the vacuum energy is just the sum of all diagrams with the topology of the sphere, exponentiating the disconnected diagrams. We can put the n squared in front. It's e to the minus n squared times some n independent number. It's this plus something of order n to the zero. Yeah? That's okay? That's okay? Okay. The second thing this accomplishes is this does at least three good things for us. The second thing it accomplishes is that if we compute correlation functions of these operators, so O1 and O2 here are any operators like this, trace class operators with where made of a number of matrices. I guess I should say it's kind of important that K is less than n here. Made of some number of matrices less than n, such objects enjoy what's known as large n factorization. Did Pedro talk about this? No? Okay, that's. I mean, I think it's probably equivalent to some things he did, but it's important to emphasize it. It's that the correlation function of two such objects is dominated by the disconnected piece. It's this plus things that are suppressed by n, by powers of n. Okay, so I'm not going to do too much to defend the statement. There's a derivation of it in here if you'd like to try to understand it better. So this property is called large n factorization, and what it means for us is that some kind of excitation in this field theory is behaving classically.
When you refer to Z is it has n to the something in the exponent. Now I have the next one.
N to the something. That's n squared.
You have order of n.
Oh, it's a zero. It's a zero.
So why didn't you just write one?
To emphasize how it scales with n. Yeah, I could have written one. right. yeah.
It's more information. thank you for asking.
This statement means that something behaves classically. That is, the correlations between the excitations created by this operator and the excitations created by this operator are small. As you take n large, these excitations behave like classical objects. You don't have to worry about any kind of quantum correlations between them. And that classicalness is the classicalness of the gravity theory. Because the claim of this correspondence is that the excitations that these operators create are well described by these fluctuations of the gravity fields. This says something is classical, right? And so this much was known since Atuf's work in 1974, more or less. But exactly what the something was wasn't identified until the late 90s. And then finally, the third thing it does for us, which I'll elaborate on in a minute, is it provides a notion of single particle states. Single particle states. What I mean by this is large n allows us to organize the Hilbert space of this quantum field theory, of such a quantum field theory, even at arbitrarily strong coupling, as a Fock space, where we can count the number of times we act on some reference state with each of the possible operators of this form. And the fact that they satisfy this large n factorization means that these are good labels to use on the Hilbert space. And this notion of single particle states, which, you know, if you like, what I mean by this is a single trace operator is like a thing that creates a single particle. I should put this in quotes. Is in fact the notion of single particle states in the bulk. That is, a single excitation of one of these single trace operators is described by a single quantum of one of the bulk fields. And so to elaborate on this a little bit, I have one more page to talk about the dictionary, and then I will stop. I'll do something to make myself feel like less of a fraud in calling myself a string theorist, and we'll actually talk about some string theory next. I don't have a good sense of the extent to which you people want me to talk about string theory. No, so. No, you don't want me to talk about string theory. You want to hear it. Okay. All right. Well, I'll do some string theory, and you know, some of you will be happy, some of the time. Okay. Right. It seems like it would be some kind of false advertising. So we'll have some string theory. But I was instructed that we have to end sharply at 12:30 today. So there's a sharp cutoff on how much string theory we can do. We'll see. Okay, so I want to say a little bit more about the dictionary. Okay, so I said this dictionary, I didn't really, let me just write it again. I said fields in the bulk. Well, I guess, sorry, I've switched my, I wrote this on the wrong side. Right, this is a gravity quantity and this is a field theory quantity. Sorry, I broke my rule. So the fields in the bulk, I said, correspond to operators in the quantum field theory. So meaning, really, each operator in the quantum field theory, any operator that you can think of, you can construct some field in the bulk, which is the dual of it. Really, really, one-to-one. And so this is kind of a big statement, which we should try to organize a little better. So how should we go about matching these guys to these guys? And the most important tool at our disposal is symmetries. So let's specialize to the case of a conformal field theory. So the more general statement is also true, but let's specialize to the case of conformal field theory. So the first thing we should do is organize the operators and into representations of the conformal group, which in the case of a 3 plus 1 dimensional field theory, it, well, I guess in general, it's SO B plus 1, comma 2. This is a statement which maybe I'll elaborate on a little bit more. Yes, good.
I wrote down earlier the fields in the bulk correspond to couplings in the CFT.
Ah, good, good.
Is that,
that's also true.
Seem to be the same as operators in the CFT? Can you explain?
It's the same because any operator, any local operator in the field theory, you can imagine adding to your action. Right? And so the its coefficient is the coupling. Yeah, so you should think about the action of the field theory as just a sum of all possible operators, with, you know, each of which has some coefficient, many of which may be zero. That's a good question. Good. Right, so that's the same correspondence. Maybe there's some raising and lowering of an index there between the two. Good, thank you for asking. Good, so we can organize these things into representations of the conformal group, which from the bulk point of view means organizing them into representations of the isometry group of entered De Sitter space. I'm not going to say too much about this. Some of it should be familiar from 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT. Right? There's this notion of primary operators, conformal primary operators, which are like highest weight states for representation of the conformal group. This is OK? Yeah? These words have passed through your ears in the past? OK. that's what I want. So then the second statement is single trace operators. Single trace in the sense that I was describing over here. So I mean things like this. I forgot to make an important comment, which I'll come back to. Single trace operators correspond to what you might call elementary, and this is a very loaded word, fields in bulk. What I mean by elementary is we have this weak coupling description of the bulk theory. The fact that there's this large N means that the bulk, the field theory in the bulk is weakly coupled. And so we can quantize it in perturbation theory. And this means that there is some good notion of what elementary is. Right? There's some basic excitation of the free field. That's what I mean. And so operators like trace x to the k squared correspond to multiparticle states. So a state like this, this is the vacuum of the CFT, corresponds to multiparticle states in the bulk. So something that you'd have to obtain by acting more than once with one of these elementary fields. So here, I'm talking about this general dictionary, which, you know, I'd like to say is applies to a very broad class of quantum field theories of size that we don't really know. But I'm using this word single trace, and let me try to say a little more about that. It's not clear what other ways there are to achieve these three desiderata. So the ATIF limit of the matrix model achieves these three things quite well. It's clear from some examples constructed from string theory that there are other ways to do it. And I say that because, so let me just make this statement. There are other examples where the number of degrees of freedom, or the number of degrees of freedom per point in the field theory goes like n to some power other than 2. I don't know, let me call it b. It goes like n to some power like 3/2, or n to the 3. And so it's clear that this is something other than just a simple matrix model. And so there's strong evidence for the existence of other ways to achieve these three things, where, you know, there would be some generalization of this notion of single trace that makes single trace operators that create classical excitations. And so this is an important open problem, which somebody needs to solve. There's been a little bit of progress on it recently about the n to the 3/2. Okay, so then the final comment I want to make over here is that simple examples of this dictionary between operators in the filter and fields in the bulk are fixed by symmetry. One thing I've already said is that the metric in the bulk corresponds by this dictionary to the stress tensor of the filter. And you can see that because, you know, I'm saying that the boundary value of this thing is the source for this operator. And so that means you have to be able to contract the indices. And so, right, the fact that this thing has two indices sticking, symmetric indices sticking out, and this thing does two, makes it very tempting to try to contract them. So that's what I mean by fixed by symmetry. And that is to say that to perturb the quantum field theory, so that is changing what the metric is at the boundary perturbs the quantum field theory by a term that looks something like what the change in the metric at the boundary times the stress tensor. And so this is really, this is exactly how you change the metric, I guess there's the square root of g, you change the metric on which the field theory is living. That's what the stress tensor means. The stress tensor of the quantum field theory is the response of the quantum field theory to a perturbation of the geometry of the space-time in which it's living. That's, you know, that's the meaning of this formula, right? T mu nu is ds dg mu nu. Okay. Gauge fields in the bulk. So over here is the bulk, by the way, in case it wasn't clear. A gauge field in the bulk corresponds by the same kind of argument to some kind of object with a single index, some kind of object operator in the field theory with a single index, which is something that might be a current, right? Something that might be a conserved current. In fact, and so you can imagine a term in the quantum field theory action which is like integral j mu a mu, right? And maybe you won't be too surprised if I say that a massless gauge field in the bulk means that the current to which it's coupled is conserved. Okay, and then I guess there are a few more simple things. A simple scalar operator over here with no quantum numbers corresponds to a simple scalar operator over here with no quantum numbers. And finally, a fermionic operator over here, which has some spinner index, corresponds over here to some spinner field. To some spinner field in the bulk. The fact that it has to be a fermion is obvious from the fact that, you know, we're going to multiply the boundary value of this guy by this guy in our perturbation of the action, and we want the action to be a bosonic object. So they'd better both be fermions, since multiplying two fermions gives a boson. Okay. And then finally, one last comment about the dictionary, and then I promise we'll do string theory. An important aspect of what I've told you so far is that the boundary values of these bulk fields determine the action of the quantum field theory, of the dual quantum field theory, right? And, you know, one usually thinks of quantum field theories with different actions as like different quantum field theories, right? This is a very kind of a dramatic thing to do, dual quantum field theory, change its action. But notice that we can study quantum field theories which are different in the sense while keeping fixed this bulk action, right? The same theory in the bulk, just with different boundary conditions, describes different quantum field theories over here. Yes, please. Oh, yeah, this is a calligraphic psi. I don't really have that font. I was just saying that, so this is just some simple scalar field in the bulk, and this thing is just some spinner field in the bulk. I was saying a spinner field in the bulk is something that corresponds by this dictionary to some fermionic operator in the boundary theory. Good. Yeah, sorry. It would be terrible if I had to finish the table over there. Right? Okay. But wait, I was yes, please.
When you refer to a geometric object in the bulk corresponding object in the boundary, do you just refer to the fallback object in the boundary?
No, not really. Well, you mean, so that's not what I mean by this arrow. I mean that there's a...
My question is, how does the metric source mu nu in one lower dimension?
Well, so I'm using this fact. I'm saying I have a field in the bulk for example, the metric and the bulk, and I need to pick boundary conditions for it in order to specify the gravity problem.
Okay.
And so what I mean by the metric on the boundary is the boundary value of the bulk metric.
Okay, so that would be the new metric.
Well, there's some, I guess, it's closely related to it. This thing should be in quotes. There's an important refinement of this statement involving some powers of z that go here, which is what's making me hesitate there, which we'll fix next time. So this is morally true, but literally a little bit misleading. So there's something that needs to be fixed there. That's why I'm hesitating. Okay, so wait, I was in the middle of making this very dramatic point, which is using the same bulk theory with the same bulk action. Just by changing it to the boundary conditions, we can study different quantum field theories. So now you might ask yourself, well, what does it mean if we change the bulk theory, right? If I, for example, change the cosmological constant, or change, you know, what the couplings of the R squared terms are, change which fields there are propagating in the bulk, and this is a much more dramatic change, and an example of such a change is if I change the cosmological constant in the bulk, that changes the ADS radius in Planck units. That changes n, right? It changes how many degrees of freedom per point there are in the boundary field theory. It's a much more dramatic change than just changing how those degrees of freedom are coupled to each other. So this is a good example to keep in mind of what it means to change the bulk action. And I guess an important point of view that one has in the back of one's mind is that which values of the bulk action and which fields one can try to put in the bulk action are possible is something that's determined from string theory, from some theory of microphysics. So then this is a good time to maybe try to say something about that. Wow. So here comes the discussion of string theory. So what I want to do is to give a sort of derivation of the ADS CFT correspondence in the particular case of n=4 supervening mills, which is due to Melvilleseina. And so I guess in my first lecture, I went on for a while casting aspersions on our understanding of string theory. Right? I was saying that all we have are these asymptotic expansions and certain limits of the theory, and really, you know, we don't. There's this Batman diagram, and we don't know what the middle of the diagram is really. But what little we do know about the middle of that diagram comes from D-brains. What little we know about non-perturbative string theory comes from D-brains, and so these are things that you encountered in Freddy's class. Yeah, is that true? Yeah, okay, good. And so let me just mention a few pertinent facts about D-brains. So these are, so they're dynamical objects. Let me say DP brain of dimension P plus 1, which at weak coupling, when the string coupling is small and we can do things perturbatively, they're defined as the set of points in space where strings can end. It's a dynamical piece of space on which open strings can end. And this definition automatically implies that that in superstring theories, they carry Ramond-Ramond charge. This is a crucial observation by Polchinski in 1995. Let's just focus right away on type DB strings, just for definiteness. So in type DB, there's some list of Ramond-Ramond fields. I guess there's odd Ramond-Ramond potentials, and for each of those possible Riemann-Riemann potentials, there's a kind of debris, which is charge under it. And what I mean by this statement is in the same way that the action of the on the world line of an electron in our universe contains a term which is an integral over the world line of the Maxwell field. Yeah, the action of the on the D brain, on a DP brain, contains a term which is an integral over the world volume of the relevant Riemann-Riemann P plus one form potential. Okay, and this means that since the action of type 2B also contains some term like F wedge star F, where F is DC, this is C, then if you look at the equations of motion for C in the presence of such a D brain, then says that there's a Gauss's law, right? It says there's a Gauss law that says that if I have n D brains at some point, then the integral of what is it, star of F P plus two, right? So F P plus two is D of C P plus one. So there's the P plus one dimensional potential. D of it is the P plus two dimensional field strength. And so there's some Gauss's law where if I integrate this object, which is like the electric flux, over a sphere surrounding n DP brains, I get n up to, I guess there's a 2 pi. OK, so hopefully this is review. Is it review? I mean, this is exactly identical to the derivation of Gauss's law in electricity and magnetism, except with a few extra indices. There's one more fact I need to say about D-brain. So this is fact one, this is fact two. Fact three is their tension, so that is their energy per unit volume, scales with the string coupling like 1 over G string. More, and I guess I could put restore units. This thing is something with dimensions of mass to the p plus 1. And so alpha prime has dimensions of mass squared. And so this is, what is it, p plus 1 over 2? Is that right? I think that's right. So this is, it scales with a string coupling like that. And this is really, how to say, the most fortuitous possible outcome. The reason it's fortuitous is that you see at weak coupling, these objects are heavy, right? If G string is small, that's some big number in string units, which means that D brains aren't wildly fluctuating objects, right? If you put them somewhere, they'll sit there for a while if they're heavy compared to the strings. On the other hand, they're not too heavy. And what I mean by they're not too heavy is that let's think about the gravitational back reaction. So it's this wonderful property of D brains that makes them so useful. Let's think about the gravitational back reaction of n D brains. I'm not going to worry about the p. Well, okay. I'm not going to specify p for a second. Let's say we're thinking about type DB strings in 10-dimensional flat space, right? In the supersymmetric vacuum in 10-dimensional flat space. This is determined by the Einstein equation, right? So there's some 10-dimensional Ricci tensor. The Einstein equation is this 10-dimensional Einstein tensor is equal to, what is it, 8 pi? 10-dimensional Newton constant times the stress tensor for the brains. Right? This is Einstein's equation in the presence of NDP brains in 10 dimensions. Let's think about whether we can ignore this, right? This G Newton goes like G string squared times alpha prime to the fourth. Is that right? Minus four. I've been messing this up. I guess it's okay. Yesterday you all reminded me that G Newton is something with dimensions of length to the d minus 2. And so, yeah, this is a better b minus 4. Huh?
So is it minus that? The half
on the bottom. This is minus?
Yeah.
Really?
It's a masculine volume. So as the volume gets, as the break gets bigger, the volume, the half function is squared. The volume gets bigger, should have more length on the bottom.
It's a length square. Sorry, isn't it? Are you saying 1 over alpha prime is the tension?
Yes, you're right.
You're right. Yeah, okay. And so this is a plus. Yeah, good. Thank you. Man. It's been too long since I've thought about string theory. okay, this is the closed string coupling. It's the factor that comes with a tree level, you know, sphere amplitude. And so this means that this object altogether, combining it with this fact, this 1 over g string, let's not worry about the alpha primes. Let's just think about the scaling with g string. This is proportional to g string squared from here times 1 over g string from here. And then let's say that there are n d brains. And so the tension is additive. I guess that's something that's worth thinking about. But the tension, it's true. The tension is additive. And so you see this goes like g string n, which is a combination of things that I'm going to call lambda. All right, I think we can do this. And so now, there's this very funny property of superstrings in 10-dimensional flat space, which is that there isn't just one such vacuum. There's, in fact, a family of such vacua parameterized by the coupling constant, by the string coupling. The string coupling is a modulus labeling different vacua. And so we can think about varying this coupling. And so let's do that. So at small lambda, at small values of this coupling, we can ignore the back reaction. Let me call that VR. Is negligible. And so the physics of this NDP brains in flat space is described by closed strings, just the ordinary closed strings, without the DP brains, interacting with the open strings, ending on the DP brains with a weak coupling. So this is in R9,1, just flat space. The closed strings you should think of as the excitations of the vacuum, right? This is the if there were no D brains there, the only thing there would be the vacuum, nothing, boring supersymmetric vacuum, and that's what the closed strings are, the excitations of that vacuum, like the graviton and all the stuff, the excitations of empty space, which. What do I mean by the back reaction? I mean the extent to which the metric which solves this equation differs from flat space, differs from just R9,1 with the flat metric, just Minkowski space, where this is zero. The extent to which the presence of the stress energy forces us to change the metric. Yeah, thank you. There was another question. Was it the same question? I thought I heard another question. Okay. All right. And at low energies, closed type 2B strings this was one of the questions that I was told to answer. Closed type 2B strings in flat space at low energies are well approximated by type 2B supergravity. Type 2B supergravity plus corrections that come from the finiteness of the string scale. You know, things like alpha prime times alpha prime to some power times curvature to some power. Okay, and then there are these open strings, which are the excitations of the D brains, which at low energies are well described by Yang-Mills theory, by some gauge theory. At not too low energies, it's well described by some Dirac-Born-Infeld gauge theory, which at even lower energies is described by Yang-Mills gauge theory plus some alpha prime. F to the alpha prime squared, F to the fourth kind of corrections. in an analogous way to this. So this thing is supergravity plus corrections, and this thing is Yang-Mills theory plus corrections. Okay, so this was a small coupling. So that's sort of the simple version, simple case. And a strong coupling, the story is much more interesting. A strong coupling, that is when lambda is large, which you can think of as fixing n and making the string coupling large, making G string large. We need to include the back reaction. And you know, if you like, there's some kind of gravitational collapse. It's a very gentle gravitational collapse, because really you can adiabatically continue lambda. And the resulting solution to those equations is called a Ramond-Ramond soliton. It was discovered before D-brains were discovered. And it's something like a black hole that carries a Ramond-Ramond charge. It's like a Reisner-Nordstrom black hole, but the charge that it carries is a p-form, people's one form gauge field kind of charge, rather than just an ordinary Maxwell field. Just for definiteness, and also because it's much simpler than the other cases, let's take p equals 3 from now on. So we're going to think about D3 brains in type 2b. And let me take n D3 brains, and let me just tell you where they are. I'm going to put them at y1 equals y2 equals y6 equals 0. So that is, a D3 brain is a 3 plus 1 dimensional object in 10 dimensions. That means there's 6 coordinates transverse to it. To specify where it is, I need to specify those 6 coordinates. And so let me pick them to be at the origin. So this fills 3 plus 1 dimensions, which, you know, this is some copy of R3, comma 1. And with coordinates x mu is 0, 1, 2, 0, 1, 2, 3. And it's at a point in R6 with coordinates y, so it's at the origin of some polar coordinates in the y directions. So I'm going to define the radial variable in the transverse directions to be r, and so r is the distance from the brains. Okay, and the solution of type 2b supergravity, I'm just going to tell you what it is the following. So you can all imagine checking that this is a solution of type 2b supergravity. It's a good exercise. So there's a bit which is just the Minkowski space along the directions of the brains, and then there's another bit. So this this is some function that depends only on the distance from the brains, and there's another bit which is just flat space in the transverse directions. Okay, so this is just R6. And so the metric that we started with was just this, right? This is just the flat space metric in 10 dimensions, where I've picked out 4 of the coordinates from the other 6. And the back reaction produces these funny factors here. It squashes the space in the transverse direction. No, it stretches the space in the transverse directions and squashes it in the directions along the brain. Okay, and this, in polar coordinates, this thing here is equal to dr squared plus r squared d omega squared, where this d omega squared is the metric on a unit phi sphere. All right, oh, sorry, there's one more field that's excited, which is this Ramond-Ramond five-form field strength is such that it satisfies this condition. Integral over the five sphere of fixed r of it is equal to n, and it's also self-dual. That's a constraint. This is the Hodge dual in 10 dimensions. That's just a property of this funny Ramond-Ramond 5 form, which you shouldn't worry about. And this function h has a particular form, which is it's equal to 1 plus l to the fourth over r to the fourth, where l is something made out of n and g string and alpha prime. there's a relationship between L and those parameters, which is, it's in fact, L to the fourth is equal to G string N times the right powers of alpha prime. I guess it's 1 over alpha prime squared. No, alpha prime squared. And this comes from the Einstein equation. So let's say Einstein implies this relationship between this parameter, which is like, it's like the ADM mass of the soliton, and N. And notice that this is a function which goes to 1 as R goes to infinity. That is, as you get far from this object, the metric just reverts to flat space. Okay. Any questions about this solution? All right, so now let me draw a picture of the solution. Here's a picture. So it's a picture where I'm going to suppress all of the x directions, and I'm only going to draw the radial direction and one of the angular directions. So far from, so this direction is r, and far from here, the metric just looks like r 9 comma 1. But as you get towards the origin in r, the geometry gets squished. These are surfaces of constant r. The surfaces of constant r here, which is something like this, you see they, we'll see in more detail in a second. They do something like this. Each of these surfaces that I'm drawing here is an S5. So far away. So this picture, by the way, is very similar to the Reisner-Nordstrom black hole, and the only difference is that in that case, this is an S2 instead of an S5. So far from the brains, far from R equals 0, so that is large R much bigger than L, the metric is just R9 comma 1. It's just flat space. That's what I said here. But near the brains, which this is sometimes called the near horizon limit, that is when R is comparable, R is less than L. So R equals L is somewhere in the middle here. When R is much less than L, this function H, you see if R is small compared to L, you can ignore the 1 here. So H approaches L to the fourth over R to the fourth. And plugging that in to the metric in this limit, the metric becomes R squared over L squared times Minkowski space plus then there's a term where square root of H multiplies the R squared. That becomes L squared over R squared. Dr squared. This is square root of h here. And then finally, there's the sphere terms, which were r squared d omega phi squared times l times the square root of h, which is l squared over r squared. So in this limit, when we go close to the brains, this function approaches the simple thing. And you see we can cancel these radii here. And this is the statement that the size of the phi sphere, as we go close to the brains, becomes a constant. So this radius here is L. And the geometry near here is, hopefully you recognize this as this is ADS5, and this is just a sphere of radius L. This is ADS5 with ADS radius L, and this is a sphere with radius L. So the geometry near here is ADS5 times S5. Okay, and so this is a big hint. And now to complete the story, which I think we can do in time, there's two more claims I need to make, which hopefully you'll believe. And then we can extract the answer. Okay, two more claims. Claim one is ultra-low energy excitations near the brain. That is the stuff, the waves propagating in here, up and down this throat, can't escape. There's this, you know, this picture is, it's like a gravitational potential well, right? The fact that this metric is blowing up near here is saying that there's a big potential that's from the gravitational potential well. There's a big potential which is keeping those excitations in there. They get stuck. The second claim is that not only can the stuff in here not get out, but the sort of converse of that is that stuff out here. So out here, there could be like civilization. It's a supersymmetric vacuum, so there's no civilizations. But there could be all kinds of stuff over here, and that stuff could try to get in there. But the second part of the claim is that stuff from R goes to infinity can't get in. That is actually, well, so it's really low energy stuff. Low energy stuff can't get in, and that is to say that the cross section, the scattering cross section for waves over here, so some kind of wave incident on the Ramondre-Ramond soliton with the frequency omega, which is small enough, at low frequencies, this goes like omega cubed L to the eighth. It's a cross section for scattering off of an object which has six transverse coordinates. So that means the area is five-dimensional. So this is a five-dimensional area. The units make sense. And the important point is that it goes to zero when the frequency is small, when the frequency is less than compared to 1 over L. And so the idea of this argument is that small frequencies mean large wavelength, and an object of wavelength which is big compared to the size of the throat just can't fit. It can't fit into this tube. That's a pretty accurate characterization of what's happening. Okay, so now all we have to do is subtract. So let's compare the low energy degrees of freedom at both at large lambda and small lambda. So at strong coupling. So over here, what we have is the states in the throat, that is these ripples over here, the stuff propagating in here, which is KTB strings in ADS 5 times S5. Right, those are the excitations of this, the vacuum over here. And then there's also closed strings in R9 comma 1, right? That's what these waves are here. That's what that stuff is. These facts 1 and 2 say that these things are decoupled from each other. At low energies, these things decouple. Okay, whereas at small lambda, what we have is Yang-Mills gauge theory, more precisely, the world volume theory on a stack of D3 brains in type 2B string theory is a four-dimensional SUN gauge theory with four supercharges, maximally supersymmetric super Yang-Mills theory. Is that statement familiar? Yeah? I'm saying which gauge theory it is. This information from studying these D3 brains at weak coupling plus closed strings in R9, comma 1. So this was, this is the world volume theory of the D brain. This is the closed strings. And the only fact left for me to say is that these two things are coupled only by irrelevant operators. That is, the coupling between the 40 Yang-Mills theory on the D brains and the closed string excitations here is it's just like coupling a gauge theory or a normalizable gauge theory to gravity. It's only through irrelevant operators, which at low energies you can ignore. Just like how, when we do particle physics, we don't have to worry about the coupling to gravity. The crucial insight of Maldacena in 1997 is to subtract this from the both-hand side of this equation. Right, so then we can, you know, we can cancel this, and what's left is. And so really, you know, this little arrow in between here is more subtle than that. Really, the more precise statement is that these two things are related by variation of varying the attempt coupling. So if we vary the coupling from weak coupling to strong coupling, this thing can be adiabatically continued to this thing. So that is to say, they are dual to each other. That's really what the word dual means. And finally, okay, so I'm 4 minutes over. Let me just conclude by the one concrete outcome of this argument is that we can match the parameters, and then I'll just write these useful things down, and then we'll stop. We can match the parameters of the two things. So the parameters on in the bulk, the bulk vacuum are labeled by the ADS radius, the number of units of flux, the string coupling, alpha prime. Not all of these are dimensionless, right? This has dimensions, this has dimensions, so they're not all independent. And in the Yang-Mills theory, the parameters are n, the number of colors, and g Yang-Mills, which naively is a coupling constant, so you know, you shouldn't think of it as a parameter in general, but there's this very annoying fact about n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory, which has destroyed the understanding of the normalization group of generations of string theorists, which is that actually it is a parameter in this case, which is that there's a line of fixed points, a line of conformal field theories labeled by this coupling constant. And so it is a parameter, and so we can define lambda is g Yang-Mills squared n. Okay, and so then there's some relations between these things. So over here, we learn from supergravity that L to the fourth in string units, in units of the string scale, is G string N, which is lambda. That is to say, from the theory of D-brains, we learn that G string is equal to G Yang-Mills squared up to pi's. Everything I'm saying is up to factors of 2 and pi, by the way. And then finally, dimensional reduction, which was what you did in the tutorial yesterday, on S5, says that the 5d Newton constant satisfies LADS to the d minus 1 is 3 over the 5d Newton constant is equal to m squared in exactly the way that we found from this holographic counting. So there's a number here. And so you can actually fix this number by this calculation, whereas the holographic counting argument left it unfixed. I don't remember what it is. But you can figure it out from the supergravity action. Okay. So from here there's some very basic checks of this claim that we can make, which I guess we'll start with next time. On Monday. I felt like I was going too slow yesterday and the day before.